morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday morning. It is the 11th of March, and very nice to have you with us. We have a lot to discuss. We have a wonderful panel to do all the discussing. And, of course, we have you, which is our, the greatest arrow in our quiver. So all we want you to do is to take part in the conversation if you so desire, and you can do that by writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love to hear from you on what you have to say on the variety of issues that we will discuss this morning. Let me introduce the group to you, and then we will get started as planned. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm all right, Joe. I'm dealing with a serious problem. The other day I tipped over the thermos. I keep my hot coffee in,
yep.
And I really caught it from Roselle for being a slob. So this morning I was looking at what could be used to rectify the situation, and I saw my grandchildren's plastic sippy cups.
Oh, there you go.
So I poured some into the sippy cup, and I've been using it. Now I'm a little concerned as to what the chemical reaction of sippy cup and hot decaf coffee might be. And so I'm sitting here.
For you or for the child?
No, the child won't ever see this particular sippy cup
okay,
again.
Okay, I got you.
There were five or six of them there.
I got
but
you.
That is my, and I'm sure we'll hear from some of our listeners on this issue.
Well, I wish Judith, you bring this up tomorrow when Judith is here, because she'll tell you all about the plastics that are
eating
its way into your decaffeinated coffee.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, good luck. I know I shouldn't take time on this, but I have to ask. So why do you need a thermos inside the house?
Well, because if you put the coffee in a regular cup, it gets cold too fast.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Don't you see?
Yeah. Yep. No, I get it. It's a long show. It's hard to keep it warm that long. Yeah. Ira Fussfeld is with us, and we are very excited. He is... I think I just threw away the whole introduction. Oh, it's two-sided. There we go. publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and everyone. I think that I've lived a long life and I've met a lot of people, but I don't believe I know anybody who has more anxiety than Alan. More anxiety than I have, and Alan may beat me on that.
Guilty as charged.
Well, it's still just coffee and cups and the like.
Yeah.
But, he's drinking from a sippy cup. He's closing in on another ripe old age birthday. And they say that, we human beings start off being diapered and drinking out of bottles. And then at the end of our lives, we start wearing diapers and drinking out of bottles. So it's just the passage of time.
So far, I'm playing nice, Ira, but that's all going to change any second.
Well, I'm including everybody. I'm just using you as the latest example.
I was really wondering why you went there, Ira, but,
All right, well, I'll go somewhere else. Another day, another Cuomo allegation.
Yay. All right, well, we'll eventually get there. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Carius Kelly, is with us. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and everyone. I have to ask about this lovely music you played right before. What was that? That was
Armic.
Really uplifting.
Armic is the group, and the name of the album is Pacifica. And as always, we have it on our playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. As far as their origins, I would have to look it up. I don't know but it's a great group. Did Sarah pick that out this morning? Yeah, Sarah.
Good job.
Yeah, good stuff. And last but certainly not least, our dear friend, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. And if you think she's primed and ready to go, it's because she just did the media project. So she's been in rehearsal for this show for the last half hour. Good morning, Judy Patrick. How are you?
I am fine. And, we talked a little bit about the sippy cup before the media project taping. And I suggested... WAMC has this great big audience. I hear it's the biggest in the region now, and I think probably every listener now would love to see a photo of Alan and his sippy cup. Post it on your website. Think of the traffic you'll get.
It seems brilliant. I love the idea. We'll see what we can do, Judy. We'll see what we can do. All right, let's get started. We'll talk about what's happening. A reminder that you can... always join us. It's very simple. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I am just waiting for the internet to load here, and we'll be, how long could that take? Not long, right?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we need some more spending on 5G networks and infrastructure.
No, I think we're, right now I got a not connected, but, all right. So, well, here's the, I have it. Okay. Yep. Thank you very much. So the relief plan has been passed. So finally, we expected it to, but it was done. And now the president has prioritized Americans in poverty, an evolution for a politician who has focused largely on the working class and foreign policy. He is, the New York Times says, the president taking on a new role, crusader for the poor. His transformation has included following progressives in his party to the left and wielding power to make sweeping rather than incremental change. Meanwhile, the stimulus package does include big benefits for the middle class, be it child care or health care. An array of tax changes and subsidies make the $1.9 trillion relief legislation more than just a lifeline for the poor. So, Alan, what do we think as this is passed? It is expected to be signed by the president tomorrow. Good news?
It's great news. And Joe, this president made a series of promises to the American people, all of which, by the way, have met with huge number of people who think it's just wonderful. So the Republicans apparently don't, because they're still afraid of Trump. But the news for the American people is really quite excellent now from a political standpoint. Unlike everybody else who BS's and says, humma, that's not what's happening here. He said he was going to make big changes, and he is making big changes. Some will call him a socialist. Some will call me a socialist. But the fact is that people will not starve. Children will not be in poverty. As many children will not be in poverty as have been. So it's an extraordinary moment in American history. And, you know, I think he's done a great job so far. We'll see what happens next.
Vera Akarios-Kelly.
I would agree. This is a very comprehensive and uplifting bill. I hear lots of conversations in the neighborhood about people feeling more optimistic that it went through, and they're expecting recovery and economic opportunity. I think there were so many good elements in this bill. And I think all I have to say about Republicans not voting for it is they're now, I mean, once again, the party of no. No to helping children, no to helping local governments return to efficient practices, because local and town governments had to lay off so many people. No to recovery. I mean, I don't really understand how this is a plan for Republicans to return to anything but, you know, sort of this marginal response that where you basically say, well, this is too much spending. Well, I think spending is important at a time when you try to get the country and the economy back on track. And this is overall a very, very positive step. And I think the vast majority of Americans, as Alan pointed out, are optimistic about what's next in the coming months. So I'm very positive.
Judy Patrick.
Yeah, it's a very good bill and will do a lot of good. But I'd like to put my reporter or my former reporter hat on and say that this is a tremendous amount of money that's going to be spent. And everyone has to pay a special attention to make sure it's spent well. I mean, just think about all the money that's going to the towns and the villages. My local town is going to get hundreds of thousands of dollars. So we have to, reporters, citizens have to take care and watch how this money is spent, to make sure it's spent well. Even just in New York State alone, $358 million is going to be spent on broadband investment, $825 million for the cities, the towns, and the villages. The state is going to get $12 billion. Let's also think about the schools that are going to get money. What are they going to spend it on? And let's make sure it's spent well. I remember after 9/11, there was a lot of money that was distributed to localities across the nation. And the question is, was that money spent well? So I think it's an opportunity. The real work begins now to make sure that this investment in our country and recovering from this pandemic, this investment is well spent.
How much do you think this legislation and how much does the administration have to do with setting the guidelines for how that money is spent and to oversee it?
There's not a lot of guidelines. That's one of the, you know, a lot of it is unrestricted. They give some general ideas for it, but I mean, for the localities, the idea was that it was supposed to compensate for lost revenue, and while a lot of places have lost sales tax revenue, places like our town, we just get property tax revenue, so we haven't lost a tremendous amount of revenue. We haven't spent a lot of money on pandemic relief. There's a lot of need out there, to be sure, but I think part of the federal plan was to give state and local governments some flexibility with this, and I'm fine with that, just as long as the citizens keep their eyes open and make sure that the money is well spent.
Ira Fussell.
Well, I'm interested, and rarely am I interested first in the politics of this. I think both Vera and Alan alluded to it. I look at this thing, and it's an important bill. It's a sweeping bill. It's an expensive bill, but it's a much-needed bill. And it's a bill that has the support of the American public overwhelmingly, passed on the behest of a president who right now has very good approval ratings, and yet not one Republican voted in favor of this bill. And I have to wonder, how are they going to go back in their districts and run against this when their opponents are going to say, you know, all that money you got for personal use or to build up this or do that, your congressman or your senator voted against it. I just don't see the strategy. I have to presume they sat around in a room and decided that this was the best way for them to go. But it baffles me how it's come to that. I defer to Alan and Vera on that.
Well, Ira, don't you think that what this is all about is fear of Trump? Trump has already announced he's going after his political enemies, he's going after the people who lean left, he's going after people who agree with Democrats, and they're all just scared to death of the guy. Not only that, but the Democrats are going to get all the credit for this thing. And where does that put them? Where does that put the Republicans? So they say, well, if they're going to get the credit, we're not going to be with them. Not only that, I just hope you're right, that when they go into the districts and say, I got you this and I got you that, and all this money is because I was there, that people will not be dumb and understand that the person is lying. But, I suspect not.
But to Ira's point, too, that given this president's popularity, at least from what we see in the polls, for however they can believe, but someone who is even being conservative in the 60s, it does seem odd that they're helping people who are greatly in need, that you do not have a single Republican that comes on.
Scared, fear. Yeah. It's just plain, blatant fear.
Well, but you know, they went against Trump when Trump wanted $2,000 before he left office, and they only passed significantly less than that. And now, if they're afraid of Trump, should they not be more afraid of polls that are supportive of legislation like this?
But do we really know whether a secret signal was given? We just don't. This is for public consumption, this $2,000. I don't really want it. Perhaps the president was saying, because, you know, when he really wanted something with these people, they just bowed and did what they had to do.
Vera, we have about a minute and a half.
Yeah, I wonder if there's another element to the strategy that's a little bit longer term. So I'm not disagreeing what you just mentioned, but in the longer run, I think Republicans are possibly waiting for the moment when Democrats will say, well, we have to raise taxes.
They have to raise taxes.
So then they will, you know, when Democrats talk about raising taxes, then they will pounce and say, well, look, if you hadn't handed out this much candy, we wouldn't be in this situation, totally ignoring all of the prior excessive tax cuts.
Yeah, Trump was a spender.
That the Trump administration pushed through for the highest earners. So I wonder if that's part of the longer term strategy for attack. You know, and also Judy, of course, mentioned potential mismanagement or any of those issues. Clearly these issues will emerge in some locations. And that, I think, is the long term strategy for burdening future generations, when in fact the burdening for future generations started long ago under the Trump administration and this massive tax cut that benefited the highest earners in the country rather than alleviating poverty.
30
great
seconds.
And important, great and important points, but I want to point out we've now had 13 letters on what kind of sippy cup to get.
And there you go. Welcome to America, ladies and gentlemen. We'll take a break. We'll let you give you some time to create your letter regarding the Sippy Cup or whatever else you would like to discuss. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. We will continue to hear from them and welcome your letters and talk about many more subjects as we go on. First, we're going to hear a news update from the the BBC. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Vera Akarius-Kelly, Judy Patrick, and Ira Fussfeld making up the group. This morning, we have some letters. Let's go to those. Mike writes, now that the COVID relief bill has been approved and soon to be signed by President Biden, I'm waiting for my Congresswoman, Elise Stefanik, to appear with local government officials when the money starts flowing. She will appear with them and act as though she busted her behind working to get it passed. Of course, the reality was she voted against both versions of the bill, beginning and final versions, and released a press release yesterday harshly criticizing the Democrats for passing such legislation. So we will see what happens there. Chris says, ladies and gentlemen, an issue has been made about the $86 billion going to pension plans. It does not seem to be unrelated to the pandemic, but perhaps your collective experience can glean some reason that this is appropriate. Does anyone want to take on the $86 billion?
We can only guess, but my guess would be that some of the pension plans are finding themselves stressed out because of all of the people who have left or who have been, you know, out of their jobs. So some lobbyists came up there and asked them to do that.
Let's see. We go to John, who says representatives who voted against the bill should not receive benefits for their states. They can explain to their constituents how much money they saved and how they looked after their district. This will save a lot of money, which they should appreciate. Oh, if only it were so easy, right?
Yeah, revenge fantasies.
Yeah, and dangerous territory because, as you all remember, Donald Trump started to say he wasn't going to send any money to New York unless it cooperated. Remember
that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. We got this from Elias. I would have capped the bill at $90,000 and given more than $1,400 to the low-income folks. That is from Elias. Then we got this from Erica. What an excellent point, Judy Patrick. What will kill the success of this bill, especially in the political arena, is lack of oversight. The federal government should set up a data collection site that states have to report to the itemization of how the money is being spent. States should willingly do this unless they intend to spend irresponsibly. Could we put it on the controller? That from Erica.
You know, there's some talk that Neera Tanden may be appointed to oversee this at the federal level. I know it's a lot to oversee it, but I think Biden does need to appoint someone to act kind of as a czar to oversee how this money is spent.
And she's free.
I was just going to say she needs a job, right?
And she has a lot of expertise.
That'd rub a lot of people the wrong way. That'd really be sticking the Republicans' nose in it.
Oh, well, that would be terrible, Ira. It would be terrible to stick the Republicans' nose in it.
It would be terrible because there's going to be plenty of other clashes. We've got a lot of big spending bills in the background on the bench. We've got to do infrastructure. There's climate legislation, just a host of things. And I think that Biden sees this as a transformative administration. It's only likely to be a one-term administration because of his age. And I believe he wants to get as many big things as possible done. And I'm hard pressed to find reasons why certain things that have been on the back burner for so long should continue to be on the back burner. If we don't do infrastructure now, then when? If we don't do climate legislation, then when? They've got to go for broke, and if the Republicans don't want to come along for the ride, take advantage of the fact that you're in the majority.
Well, the last part of what you said is brilliant and right on target. The first part, not so much. The fact of the matter is, oh, please, please hit me again. Biden came on, said he wants to cooperate. They said, in your ear, we are not going to allow that to happen. And we're going to be unified in our opposition to anything you do. And as far as I'm concerned, it would be just fine that he shows a little bit of muscle now.
Vera.
Well, I just wanted to point out that Neera Tanden would be a fabulous czar because of her extensive experience with the federal bureaucracy, her ability to reflect the Biden administration's decisions in targeting poverty-related measures and uplifting particular regions and areas of the country. So I think she would be a good choice for that position, as a matter of fact. And I agree with Ira that we better have some infrastructure plans for the near future because we are falling behind in comparison to, I think one of the discussions we might get to later is in contrast to up-and-coming China, but also the Europeans have invested more. So there is this competitive environment where we're falling behind. And this is the time to invest in those kinds of massive projects because, the opportunity emerges, the Biden administration is ready. And if Republicans think that bipartisanship means they can always say no and therefore change away from what this administration hopes to pursue for the general public, then I think they're misunderstanding bipartisanship. It just gives them an opportunity to make adjustments or make additional proposals, but to constantly say, no, we won't participate, that's on them.
Ira, were you going to say something?
Nope.
Okay. All right, let's go. Oh, we have this from Rita, and this is important. Rita says, look, if you're looking for something that keeps your beverage hot for a really long time, the Yeti cup, the Yeti sippy cup,
yeah,
it will change your life.
She and about two dozen other people have checked in, including somebody who has seriously embarrassed me in saying WAMC has its own sippy cup.
Well, it was
been a premium.
Yeah.
So that's a serious embarrassment. Yeah, come on, Alan.
Yeah, it's not really. Okay, I would take issue with that because I believe that was a part of the Tanglewood package, and it was to put wine in, and it would keep your wine cold and not spill on the. So it's, I don't know if I would, yeah. But anyway,
I'm sure I'll hear from our wonderful national leader, Amber Sickles, who will let me know.
Yes, but they're very nice, and you can see they're in the drop-down menu. So, okay, more letters. Go to Kenneth. It's partisanship, stupid. The Republicans are repeating their strategy under Obama. They're voting as a bloc to oppose everything and then to cry what they voted against is lacking bipartisanship and unity. It's circular and self-serving, says Kenneth. Then
yes, I would agree.
Well, I agree with what he said. I have certain resentment for the word stupid.
Well, but the circular argument about, you know, bipartisanship, I think, was the central argument.
Ricky says some are saying the federal, I love that, some are saying, we'll find out who, that the federal relief plan is socialism. But I say the majority of these potential beneficiaries have paid taxes through the years. Therefore, they are just getting some of those taxes back.
Well, he's right, of course, but it is socialism. I don't know why we should run away from that. You know, the fact of the matter is that the people who have been screwed on the lower end of our economic, you know, diagram are ready to get something back. The post office is socialism. The schools are socialism. And to me, this is just a ridiculous kind of claim.
All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many more items to discuss. We will do so. We have a great panel, Alan Chartok, Vera Carius-Kelly, there we go, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. They will all be here, as well as your letters, panel at WAMC.org, right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. This morning, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Real quick, this letter from Linda says, my 94-year-old aunt in Maine called to say she was upset that they, the Democrats, were wasting all our money by, quote, giving it away to lazy people. She lives on her Social Security check and is normally a reasonable person. But when she turns on right-wing TV, she becomes illogical in reference to politics. This reminds me of the diatribe I heard in Connecticut growing up in a Republican household that the welfare mothers were wasting the taxpayers' money. Seems as long as the money people have theirs, the right-wing media continually attack those in need as lazy or dependent on government assistance. Same old tactic that still works with so many people. Yes.
Yes.
All right. But we still love our aunts and uncles and all those relatives around us who may have different opinions than us. And we just try to reason with them and realize that we can hang up when we want to. Okay.
Including Uncle Irving.
Yes. We deal with our Uncle Irvings in our life and then we move on. Speaking of moving on, let's go to another story this morning. And there is... I think a couple ways. While we're talking about the federal government, let's go to Merrick Garland, who was confirmed as Attorney General. The federal judge will take over a Justice Department battered during the Trump administration and confronting the threat from domestic terrorism. The Senate voted to confirm Garland on Wednesday, giving the former prosecutor and widely respected federal judge the task of leading the Justice Department. He was confirmed 70-30, 20 Republicans joining all 50 Democrats and supporting him. He's expected to be sworn in at the Justice Department today. So, pretty good news for a guy who, you know, kind of got it several years ago.
Yes, and on that level, it's a great thing, Joe. You know, they're getting back a little of their own, and hooray. And you wonder about the 30 who deserted the Republicans. Is that what you said, 30, something like that?
Yeah, 20 or 30.
Yeah, 20, 30. Yeah, you know, and you wonder about them. Look, these are people, gutless individuals, who haven't been able to stand up to this president no matter what. But when it comes to ticking off the Attorney General of the United States, maybe, just maybe, not such a good idea.
Ira.
I saw a comment somewhere on the internet yesterday that Mitch McConnell, who did vote in favor of Garland yesterday, he might regret blocking Garland from getting on the Supreme Court when the Garland Justice Department grabs a hold of some of these investigations that may not be very favorable to the Republicans. But clearly this guy is qualified. He was screwed, to use the technical term, about the Supreme Court. And, you know, I look forward to a Justice Department that is going to approach its business even-handedly and in the manner in which the department was set up to begin with.
Mr. McConnell said on the Senate floor before he cast his vote, I'm voting to confirm Judge Garland because of his long reputation as a straight shooter and legal expert. Mr. McConnell said that he hoped Judge Garland would bring his no-nonsense approach to confront the challenges facing the Justice Department and the nation, and that he would keep the department on a centrist path. Judy Patrick.
Well, he certainly has his work cut out for him. He has to, you know, restore public trust in the Department of Justice, which was trashed by Bill Barr. I would say he's got to deal with all of the insurrectionists that stormed the Capitol on January 6th. He's got this, you know, Hunter Biden case that the right wing wants him to pursue, as well as that investigation into the Russian investigation that Barr started out of the Southern District or out of Connecticut. So that there are all these cases, but especially this idea, this notion of domestic terrorism and how, you know, our country is going to address those problems. That's a lot of work to do. And then at day one, he's got to work on, you know, making people trust this Department of Justice. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of work and a lot of good to be done, but he's going to have that right wing nipping at his heels all the time to do what they want him to do.
Vera.
So, yeah, I agree with a lot of the, you know, comments that were made. And I think Garland has You know, of course, I mean, so it's sort of so interesting, all the issues he'll have to deal with. Social justice questions, you know, unaddressed systemic racism questions, policing, the whole domestic terrorism agenda. He has a lot of experience, and I find it so interesting the way McConnell phrased, his support for Judge Garland in terms of calling it a no-nonsense approach. I mean, I wonder if he was, McConnell was thinking that he would give a little bit of a, with his vote, a little bit of a, the air of protecting sort of a centrist approach that Garland could then use to sort of strengthen the department, the Justice Department, and then begin to shelter him just a little bit from the right-wing nip, as Judy called it, regarding the sort of domestic terrorism issues. But, you know, McConnell, I don't know what to say about him. He's the one who caused, you know, I do.
Oh, I think we have a lot to say about, but go ahead.
I know we have a lot to say, but I shall not say it on the radio. That's
well, you know, to show you in part how journalism has changed over the years, I want to see if Judy agrees with me. In the New York Times report on this morning, and talking about when Garland was nominated to the Supreme Court, and the Times says his nomination was held up for 8 months in an audacious political maneuver by McConnell. Can you remember the New York Times? Or there was a time that word audacious would not be used in any straight news story, but now it's just that kind of description is part of the vernacular.
Am I wrong
about that, Judy?
So what do you think? What do you guys think?
Well, it was audacious, right?
It was audacious, but I believe that word is, for want of a better word, editorializing.
Judy?
Right. It's a loaded word that we tend to discourage reporters from using a lot of adjectives in their reporting because they're typically loaded words like that. But I would concede at some point that was an audacious move on his part. I mean, McConnell would argue otherwise, but I think history will prove it to be audacious.
Well, I think it already has. I mean, given hindsight being 2020, I mean, we've already gone through the time now, 8 years, right? So, yeah, or 4 years, right? 4 years. That's pretty audacious, right, Alan? I mean, it seems like...
Well, I'm all for it. It's just that the pompousness of the journalistic community somewhat.
I thought that show was over. Is that?
Yeah, I wasn't on this week. I thought I'd get a pass.
Yeah, I would. All right. Let's go to letters. Robert says, infrastructure. I thought Trump's infrastructure plan introduced during Infrastructure Week took care of all of America's infrastructure woes during his 4 years in office. Oh, wait a minute. I forgot that never happened. Robert and the sarcasm alert. Steve says, Alan just announced that the COVID-19 bill will lift many children out of poverty. How? Its provisions are lifelines and not even at maintenance levels. Just slows the decline. It doesn't contain wage increases. It doesn't contain jobs. It's just limited time life support, which provisions lift impoverished children out of poverty. How many and for how long?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, there's a whole article in the New York Times today about about President Biden working so hard to try to appeal and to help the poor at a very strong level to indeed lift them out. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, all I know is what I read. And I read in the Washington Post and the New York Times, I believe, and the major newspapers, that this was a tremendous help to get kids out of poverty. So it may not be so, but that's what I read.
So I wanted to also add a comment to that, if I may.
Yes.
So I agree with the letter writer that, in fact, this is a short-term initial step, right? Additional money for families, financial support for children, support for schools, and this is expected to be the first step. It's not enough to lift children out of poverty in this country. It will lift them out of poverty for a shorter period of time, perhaps for a few months. And then the expectation is that we will address additional issues in this country to make some payments more permanent in the system. Because, in fact, a lot of families have fallen behind in their payments. So when they get a cash payment, they may have to actually invest it in some debt. They may have other pressing issues in the family. So the letter writer is correct. This is not an answer to a long-term answer or even a shorter-term answer to child poverty, but it's the first step, and it is indeed overdue and necessary. And after these payments, we will need not only a chance for families to pay immediate needs, but also to uplift themselves and have opportunities to enter the job market and create some stability for their children.
So, I mean, it is baby steps, and you have to start somewhere, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's... Mm-hmm. And this is a good place to.
Now, what would the critics want? Do we want to have a country where there are kids dying of starvation, or they can't afford to buy clothes, or you know what? Name your example. It's sure we would rather not spend our money on that way, but people in this country need it, and we have an obligation to provide it. And I'm not sure what the alternative is.
Right. But here's the thing. The long-term question is, so I wanted to give a counterexample from Germany, right? So Germany, and I'm making a joke now, is obviously a deeply socialist country, right? Yes. Germany's known as having a capitalist economy. Germany, however, the federal government, does give families a monthly payment for children to help families with the expenses of feeding, clothing, educating their children. So there is a sponsorship, a federal agreement to sponsor families with children. So you get a monthly payment for the first child, second child, and third child. They go down in payments, but there is a basic amount that families get. So that's the kind of question over the long run that the United States should consider, especially for families who are not earning an income that can sustain large expenses, including rent, including maintaining a car, and so on.
Alan, it does seem that whenever, sure. I mean, to the point of the letter writer, that, you know, what we're doing isn't enough. And I guess that's always the case, though, right? I mean, anyone can say so, what we do is it's not going to be enough.
So here we have a 1.9 T, that's T, trillion-dollar package, which was opposed by every Republican in the both houses of the United States Congress. That's extraordinary. It's a great first step. Nevertheless, I wouldn't be that quick, Vera, or anybody else, to dismiss this as a great advancement, recognizing child poverty and the insidious nature of it, and saying, all right, this is our roadmap, this is where we're going, and fulfilling promises that he made during the campaign. I don't think we should be eating our own. Let's put it that way.
I don't think I disagree with anything you said. I just agreed with the letter writer saying this is not an answer. This is a first step. And I think on that note, we agree. Poverty, child poverty in particular, is a huge problem for supposedly the wealthiest country in the world.
I hear you.
Yes.
I hear you getting ready
Which people are making.
You're idling. You
know, well, people are doing their best to get into this country. We know that, including some of the poorest people in the world.
Well, so they do the same in Europe. It depends on what access you have. From North Africa and the Middle East, you get towards Western Europe from, you know, I mean,
I know this is going to be somewhat controversial, and I apologize in advance, but if you give people a chance to argue whether they'd like to come to the United States or to Germany, what do you think they'll choose?
They'll choose depending on where prior family members have moved to. When you look at
I'm talking refugees. Gross numbers now. I'm talking gross numbers. I'm talking about if people have a chance to come to this country, or to go to, to Germany. Where will they go? You say it depends. I say nonsense. I say they want to come here for good reasons.
You have not looked at the data. You should look at
what makes you think that
comes to Europe.
Yeah.
Namely, it depends on your ethnic relationship. It depends on prior migrants. It depends on where you are more welcome based on your heritage. These decisions, and in addition to that, if you're a refugee and sit in a refugee camp and you get processed by UNHCR for approval for migration, those numbers are put out to the international community, and whichever country offers you a spot, that's the one you get.
Vera,
and that's
we're
how
talking,
a lot of these decisions are made.
We're talking gross numbers here, and I'm sticking with what I'm saying. You give a person a chance to go to either of those countries, and we know where they're going to go. Now, you can say, Alan, you're not looking at the numbers. You can say any of that stuff. But in terms of the numbers of people who make these decisions, I'm telling you what's up.
Well, and I recommend you look at some of the data because
I look at data all the time.
By the size of the United States and its population, the numbers aren't that high.
All right. Let's hold there. And we will.
It's because you're not letting him in.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
All right.
I enjoy it when Alan is arguing with Vera because that means he's not arguing with me.
We all take our breaks so we can get him.
There's still plenty of time.
That's right. You'll be tagged in eventually, Ira. Don't worry. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 11th of March. Very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok, Vera Carius, Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick making up the panel this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. President Joe Biden will give a primetime address marking the anniversary of the pandemic and its related lockdowns. The speech is at 8 o'clock tonight. He'll applaud his COVID-19 relief bill, and he is expected to sign that on Friday. He will also likely preview life as restrictions ease and more people become vaccinated. Of course, we will be running that and airing his speech, which is expected to go about 20 minutes or so tonight, beginning at 8 o'clock right here on WAMC. So if you're the president and you're going out and making the sale here, even though the bill is already passed. But Alan, of course, he's marking the one-year anniversary of many of the lockdowns in this country and talking about the road forward. What does the president need to say tonight?
Well, whatever he says, it has to be supportive of this Herculean effort that he has made to get this thing through. Now, he could just shut up, but that would be a mistake. What he has to do is go around, and he's going to go around and talk to everybody in this country and say, look at what we have all done together. That's what this is all about. And, that's part of his program of reconciliation, and he's doing it, and he'll keep doing it.
Judy Patrick.
You know, it's such a normal thing to do, don't you think, for the president to have a primetime address?
It's his first primetime address since becoming president on January 20th. But yes, it is a normal thing to do.
You know, what I would like to see from the federal government at this point is more messaging about vaccination to reach those people who are still skeptical about it. I'm not seeing enough of that at this point, and I'm worried. I know it's still hard for a lot of people to get appointments and to get their vaccines, but that first rush is almost over, and there are a lot of people out there that are still shaking their heads. And we've got to have our best minds think about ways to convince people about why this is for the general good for everyone to get this vaccine.
I just saw a brief clip this morning of a new PSA featuring Bush, Obama, Clinton and Carter and spouses all getting the vaccine or speaking up the vaccine. Trump was nowhere to be found in those clips. And as we've learned recently, Trump and his wife, in fact, did get the vaccine before he left office. but he did it in private as opposed to showing his followers and other doubtful people that he was getting the vaccine and it's good for you. So I have, for those of you who have missed Trump on Twitter, and that makes nobody, I think, but he put out a statement. Have you seen the statement, Joe, that he
put out?
I
did, yes.
Yeah, it's briefly. He says, I hope everyone remembers when they're getting the COVID-19, parenthesis, often referred to as the China virus vaccine, that if I wasn't president, you wouldn't be getting that beautiful shot for 5 years at best, and probably wouldn't be getting it at all. I hope everyone remembers. A statement by Donald J. Trump, 45th president of the United States of America.
And perpetual 12-year-old.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Well, yes, but I mean, there have been, so I think that was, we're starting to see these statements more instead of Twitter. I think he must feel that he's getting some traction out of them. But they're press releases that are sent. And yeah.
This is from a guy, Joe, who has never really got over 40%, a little bit maybe, compared to a man who is pushing 70% right now. It's got to be killing him.
Yeah. Ira, anything you want to say about the president's speech tonight?
No, only to echo what was said regarding Biden's approach to this. He has surprised me, not that he has to worry about surprising me, but he has pushed almost all of the right buttons in terms of speaking to the public straightforwardly, you know, in short strokes that are understandable but relatable. The only thing that concerns me, and I'm afraid it's probably only the media people who are concerned about it, is that he has not had a formal press conference yet. I think he needs to do that. But I just think he's been tremendous, that he's rarely made a misstep. I must confess, every time I see him shuffle out to a microphone, I get nervous because he is an old man. I mean, I'm doing a little shuffling, and I'm younger than he is. But I hope he's got the stamina for this because it makes me nervous when I see him out there.
So why isn't he having a press conference, Ira?
I wonder that too because he's you know, I don't know if it's that his aides are afraid to put him out there without a script, or if he feels that he wants to show the public that he's concentrating on doing their business and he'll get around to that when it's time. And now would be the time if that's the reason, because he's cleared this first big hurdle with the relief bill. What do you think?
I think you can only get hurt in those press conferences.
Yeah, well, that's right, particularly if he makes a misstep.
Yeah, and, well, even if it's not a misstep, you'll have somebody in that group, maybe from Fox, maybe from one of those other places, will hold up their hand and ask, why are you beating your wife, question which cannot be easily answered.
He seems to have gotten along very well with the Fox reporter, whose last name is Ducey. He's the son of the guy who's on the morning
Steve
show.
Steve Ducey's
son. And
they've
had some interactions when the reporters have sort of in passing fired questions at him. And he's handled Ducey very well. And I saw an interview with Ducey who acknowledges that, he's had access to Biden.
That's good.
Yeah.
Do you remember Peter Ducey is the name of the reporter for Fox, who is the son of Steve Ducey, who is the host of Fox and Friends, one of the three hosts of Fox and Friends.
He's the Louis Gohmert of Fox.
Yes, he is the former Ira. You may be the only other person in the room, but when Barry Sann left the Letterman show, he went to produce a program called Steve Ducey's House Party, which was from the famed 8H studio at NBC that lasted about 2.5 weeks. And was the most hideous television program in the world. Yeah, it was really horrible. It went like for 3 hours of him just like mumbling around.
He didn't succeed Art Linkletter's house party.
That's right. That was what it was based on.
Yeah,
all right.
Steve Ducey says the strangest things.
He does indeed. I wanted to get just Vera. I want to bring you in on what the president said. I do want to point out real quick though that. It is true that Biden has. Oh, Judy, what are your thoughts on this? Biden has gone longer without a press conference than any president in the last 100 years. This, according to ABC News, from this morning. He has yet to hold a formal news conference, solo news conference, raising questions about accountability with the White House under increasing pressure to explain why, even as the nation deals with multiple crises, a deadly pandemic, and the devastating economic fallout, Biden has gone longer without facing extended questions from reporters than any of his 15 predecessors over the past 100 years.
You know, I'm okay with it because...
Me too.
I'm in large part because he has his proxies out there doing these really meaty, informative press conferences. I mean, Jen Psaki's out there every day, and she offers real answers to real questions. Former President Trump, I guess we could call those press conferences, but they were kind of like stream of conscious rants that weren't really answering real questions that were posed and were offering real answers. I mean, I don't think you could, that wasn't a give and take. I think I'm getting a ton of information out of this administration from his surrogates. If he eventually does a press conference, that's fine, but that's not a howling need on my part.
I think we learned something about presidents when you look at them at these press conferences. You know, we learned plenty about Trump, not necessarily favorably. When Obama had press conferences, we learned how long-winded but studious and knowledgeable of subject matter he was, and on and on. And I think that the public has to take the measure of their president. And one way to do that is to see how he responds on his feet to questions from reporters.
Vera?
And if you got a 70% approval rating or pushing that, or a 65% approval rating, and the people love you, why, as Lucille Ball once said, why mess around with success? Yeah. Only she didn't say mess.
Well, as Ricky Ricardo would say, he has some splaining to do.
Well, I would say actually he sends a very positive message through the fact that he focuses on legislation, on achieving his agenda, on working out huge problems related to vaccine access and plans. I think most people agree with what Ellen and Judy said early on that, you know, he's doing his job as president, and staffers, including Jen Psaki, is doing a fabulous job answering questions and sharing information. So, yes, it might be unusual that he doesn't provide press conferences, but really at this point, I don't feel that I'm underinformed or don't have access at what the in terms of explanations or information on what the government's plan is so far.
Here's the other thing I don't quite understand about it. He had a number of them during the campaign, and he did fine. I don't know exactly what the concern is. I mean, obviously it's a bigger stage, but that's the job, and so I don't get it quite what the plan is there, but whatever. I did want to get to a breaking story here that we just learned of about the judge in the George Floyd, the Derek Chauvin murder trial. The judge has reinstated the third-degree murder charge. The judge overseeing the trial of the former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd reinstated that charge of murder this morning, paving the way for the trial to proceed as scheduled. The decision was a victory for the prosecutors, who had sought to reinstate the charge against Chauvin, the white officer filmed with his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes during a police investigation last May. He is already charged with second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter in the black man's death. On Wednesday, the Minnesota Supreme Court declined to take up the appeal filed by Eric Nelson, Chauvin's attorney, seeking to overturn a state court of appeals ruling that ordered Cahill to reconsider a third-degree murder charge in the case. The appellate court issued a final judgment in the case and then sent the issue back to the county district court, who was overseeing the trial and heard arguments on the issue this morning. So,
well, clearly, Joe, they want to give the jury options. They're concerned, obviously, the prosecutors are concerned about that. You have the third degree, you have second degree. There is a compelling reason to do it, I think, and they win. The prosecutors win.
Judy?
Yeah, it's tracking appeals of dismissed charges is always difficult for the average person to follow. The bottom line here is the need for that a jury to be selected that's representative of the community. And as you listen to the jury, the voir dire, they call it, you can see how difficult a task it is, because there are so many people that bring so many opinions into the courtroom. You know, you're never going to get a blank slate as a juror.
Right.
Those kind of calculations go into, you know, choosing that. But it seems like it's going to be a very difficult process for them to get a jury and to get a verdict that's going to be satisfying to that community, that's going to be just. What an incredibly difficult situation for the victim's family and for their community.
Ira?
Well, we've all seen the video, and it's a startling video, to say the least, and you have to wonder what the defense is going to be built on. I haven't been following the juror questioning, and I'm wondering whether they're asking if potential jurors have seen the video, and if so, if they're automatically disqualifying them. Do you know that, the answer to that?
They are asking that, and some of them have, and some of them, and they aren't being automatically disqualified. I listened to one man who had seen some still images of it, but they were not being automatically disqualified.
I mean, the other thing too, the big as far as the voir dire process is that they were not allowed to mention that Chauvin was fired as a result of his actions, so the jury would not know that.
But of course, they do know that.
Well, maybe they do, and maybe they don't. But let's put it this way: no one in that courtroom is telling them that, right?
Right. Okay. Exactly.
Vera.
Well, I think what the Minnesota courts wanted to make clear is that they are. I mean, in essence, they're saying there have to be opportunities for the juries to reflect on different levels of finding the accused police officer potentially responsible. And they didn't just want to have one option, they wanted to have multiple options on the table, because both second and third degree murder in Minnesota, they have mandatory sentencing guidelines, and those are long. Of course, related to murder, and deservedly so when you are accused and convicted of murder. But we're talking about between, you know, now sort of the range of actually serving sentences between 15 and 40 years. That's sort of the range at the moment that we're looking at. So it is good for jurors to reflect what the level of culpability is, the level of intent, and in addition, there's great concern in Minnesota for the community to be outraged by an outcome that is not just. And I think Judy addressed this whole question of how will the family of the victim respond to a judgment. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot of conversation among friends and family members and interviews that members of the Floyd family are giving. So George Floyd deserves justice. So does his family. So do various communities in Minnesota. And this was a really good choice to have multiple options to be discussed by the jurors.
Alan, we have a few moments before we have to take our bottom of the hour break. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping you will tell me a story, because sometimes I forget the details.
Yeah.
So when you say keep shut, what is the background to that story?
I had a math teacher in the eighth grade who used to say, Shartok, keep shut.
Yeah. And I thought we knew the name of the math. Did you know the name of the math?
Well, it was either Mrs. Weingarten or Mrs. Wick.
Okay, I thought it was Mrs. Wick. It was how I had heard the story, but okay.
Right.
Keep shut. So
keep shut.
With that story in mind, I ask you, what was Prince William thinking when he said to the press yesterday, or today actually, we're very much not a racist family.
Yeah.
This in a response to the accusations, the damning accusations that were made by Harry and Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, to Oprah Winfrey, which aired in the UK on Monday and in the United States of America on Sunday.
Right you are. Right you are. This is a perfect example of a good time to keep shut.
I mean,
there may be some sibling rivalry here, you know.
Well,
I hate to get into it.
Yes, but you, is it, I don't know, like, it's almost cliche, isn't it, Ira, at this point, to say, well, I'm not a racist. I mean, I don't, how do you get away with that? I don't.
Well, what would we, should he have just walked by and not said anything?
I mean,
that's certainly
keep
an
shut.
Option.
Mrs. Wickham.
No, he could have said, I love my brother.
Yeah.
He could have said, I love my brother.
There you go, which is what Harry said, actually. That was the first thing he said. I love my brother to bits, although, you know, we have issues. Go ahead, Vera.
I mean, you know, you could have said things like, you know, I really am saddened by all the pain and suffering, some acknowledgement of what was articulated in the interview, instead of being immediately defensive and reject that is, you know, not the basis for their pain. Well, in essence, I'm sorry, but now if one just looks at the royal family and how they got to be there and how they are maintaining themselves, clearly you could accuse the entire structure of systemic racism. Good grief. The entire royal household.
It's a hard thing not to. Judy, what do you think?
It's not like Prince William didn't have time to think about
exactly.
This.
And the family like labored over a statement for 48 hours before they released it. Why not just stay with the company line?
Because it's very hard not to respond to some of these people. I mean, I get letters. I just got one from some guy in Ulster County. You know, they make terrible things, and you want to scratch that itch. You want to say, what a
is this
jerk
against
you
about
are.
William or about against you?
Against me.
Oh, okay.
Did they make
a sippy cup or
what? Do you mean? Wait. What do you mean? Oh well.
Oh, who said that? I didn't say that.
I believe.
Was that Vera?
I mean, what I'm saying is, you know, when you articulate a position publicly, you're automatically having opponents out there. This is just part of what happens.
But,
so you can't always take it personally,
To your point, Alan, that yes, it is hard not to scratch the itch, especially when it's something so personal, and especially when it's, you know, God forbid, your brother. That must be difficult. Although, you know, we're not talking about novices here. These are people who have been in the public life their entire lives for a billion years, and it just is hard to believe that you could make a mistake
It could be, Joe, that somebody wants to say, okay, you know, somebody in the family, the firm as this now being called, has to make a response. Now, who's our most popular person? Who's most likely that we should trot out to do this right now? And maybe that was the misjudgment.
Yeah, because you do that initially. I agree with you. You do that initially, though, with the Queen's statement of saying, you know, we're going to handle this privately. And then not 24 hours later, you have Prince William, the future King of England, make that comment. But I find it interesting.
The other thing that I was disappointed with Prince William for, he was asked if he'd reached out to Harry yet. Nope, not yet. It seemed like that. He is the older brother.
Yeah.
It seems like he should have reached out, and he came across as callous.
And can you imagine being a black British citizen, or being your heritage is, you know, Indian or Pakistani or Bangladeshi, and this is the message from the White House? Good grief. What an absolutely...
Sorry. Buckingham Palace.
Sorry. The
Palace.
Royal Palace. I apologize.
Yeah.
Royal Palace. And,
that was good, Ira. I like that. I hope people heard
that. You know, I mean, it's just so shocking in terms of the large percentage of minority populations in the UK. I mean,
all right.
How devastating.
We are out of time for this break. We'll be right back. In a few moments, we have much more to discuss. We'll wrap things up with our panel, Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick. We do welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to the last segment of our panel segment this morning. Alan Chartok, Vera Acarius Kelly, Ira Fussfeld, and Judy Patrick all participating in the discussion this morning. Let us end with what I like to call press release roulette. Let's spin the wheel, and we begin with this press release coming to us from John McDonald III, Assembly Member of New York State. The public trust is fundamental when elected to public office. We are at a point now where Governor Cuomo is the subject of multiple investigations, and the number of allegations continue to grow. Since the governor has said he will not resign, I believe it is in the best interest of our state if Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul serves as acting governor until the Attorney General's investigation or any other potential inquiries reach a conclusion or a removal determination under the law is made. These are serious allegations, and the people of New York State need steady leadership without distraction. We spin the wheel once more, and we end with Mayor Kathy Sheehan, the mayor of Albany, New York, who says the act of speaking out after being victimized can be deeply painful and traumatic experience. At this time, no criminal complaint involving the matter that has been reported. This, of course, is the latest woman, the Times Union, reporting the story of a woman who was allegedly groped at the governor's mansion. The attorney general has commenced an investigation into previous allegations against the governor, and I have the utmost confidence in her ability to investigate this latest report. At this time, no criminal complaint involving the matter has been filed by the victim with the Albany Police Department, but Chief Hawkins assured me that the Albany Police Department stands ready to assist any victim who seeks to come forward. And for our final contestant in press release roulette, we go to Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, who this morning in a statement released just moments ago during our last break, it's a one-liner with a comma. In light of the allegations concerning the governor over the last several weeks, I will be meeting with members in conference today on potential paths forward, period. ###. Okay, so what does that mean, Alan?
Well, you know what it means. It means he's considering impeaching the governor. He's put his foot into the water. There's no question about that. We know that, and he's done that now.
Because his statement now, Sunday was kind of mamby-pamby, right? I mean, Cousins came out and said he should resign, and Hastie was like, oh, he should start thinking about it.
We know where he is.
Yeah.
We know where he is and what he wants. And so now that – and I got going to guarantee you that the governor knows what he wants also. So I'm always interested, unlike others in this game, I'm always interested in potential motivations. What made somebody say something? What was it that made Hastie say something? Was it he knows that right now he's got a fierce enemy and he better kill him or else? I don't mean kill him physically, but politically. McDonald saying, put his finger up into the air and say which one is, wet it and see which way is the wind blowing during this time. To me, it's quite simple. Let the investigation go forward and then proceed on the basis of what you've learned.
Ira Fussfeld.
Well, I agree with that, but I have to ask a question and tell me if I'm wrong at some place. Because I've listened to a lot of the commentary here and elsewhere. I've read a lot of the commentary and the stories. And one thing that I have not seen mentioned at all, or at least in a large degree, is the question of the sexual harassment training. And I would believe that I know in the private sector, it's for years, long, I've been retired 7 years. We were doing it before I retired. I presume in state and other government levels, all the employees from the top one all the way down receive sexual harassment training and sign off on it. And the reason I bring it up is because although Cuomo has denied on the one hand that he's done anything wrong, it seems to me that in at least two statements that he made publicly, he acknowledged violating sexual harassment or not paying attention to sexual harassment training. That is, in the first one, where he said, I apologize if I did anything that made people uncomfortable. And the second one, more damning, I thought, was that the people didn't say there was anything wrong at the time.
Right. And this is how I operate.
That's right out
this
of Sexual how, Harassment Training yeah. 101, Hostile Work Environment 101. And he's acknowledging, he may not be acknowledging exactly what's being alleged, but he's acknowledging something. And if this was, I think Rosemary has said this a number of times, if this was in the private sector, he would have been fired by now.
Well, and you wonder even in other branches of the state government. I mean, the state government, the New York State, has sexual harassment training videos on their site that are used by businesses throughout the state, and there are you're tested on them. And I have heard commentary that said, you know, would the governor be able to pass this very simple test if he were honest in responding
well,
to
has he already taken
the
it?
Question?
Well,
well I have no
course,
idea. I have no
off.
Idea. Yeah,
no,
I have no idea.
He has taken it. He was asked this at a news conference, and he said he indeed has taken the sexual harassment prevention training.
Was not a good student.
I would agree with that. Some of these patterns that are emerging clearly show that he uses his position of power to pressure staffers. I mean, it's quite basic, and he has failed all trainings.
So this question of impeachment, does this make sense right now to if you are the speaker, Hasty, and you say, okay, we're going to discuss this? Of do you think, because there was some question a few days ago of whether they would have the votes, and now with more and more people coming out and making statements, such as Assemblyman McDonald, who didn't call one way or the other, but you know it seems like he's as you say, Alan, putting his finger in the air. Do you feel like you may have the votes?
Well, he could have the votes, but I got to tell you, there are an awful lot of Democrats who are thinking now that would be a terrible error. To convict somebody in your own party. They may think that they'll be getting kudos for doing it, and people will say, oh, well, you know, you're terrific because you're standing up no matter what the political party is, and that will certainly be an argument that they will make. Nevertheless, I think it's a very dangerous course for them.
I'm just playing devil's advocate here and not with you, but just in general. But I don't understand then, because can't you make the statement of still cover your political behind, if you will, by saying I'm standing by and waiting for the results of the investigation?
Well, you could, but I think that
I guess I'm asking why that isn't good enough.
Ms. Stewart-Cousins and the speaker seem intent on pushing this thing forward. Now, the legislature, as you know, is an oligarchy, meaning no matter what they tell you about how they raise questions in conference and everything, the head person in either of these houses stands for a great deal. And people don't, because they can take a lot away from you if you mess up. And so it is, to me, remarkable that they are going down this road. And I think that they may find out that it's a mistake.
Judy Patrick.
You know, when it comes to the good of New York State, it seems like there are no good options here. Waiting for the Attorney General's investigation, that's going to take a few months. Let's not forget, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and we have major financial problems to deal with in New York State. So you've got the Attorney General's investigation a couple of months. And an impeachment, my God, that's not going to be quick or easy. Having him resign is not going to be easy. I mean, we're in a time for strong leadership. We need to get us out of this mess. These are really, really serious charges. And the Times Union story today or last night upped the severity of this incredibly. He can't pass mm-hmm. this off as, oh, my actions were misinterpreted. I don't think you misinterpreted somebody reaching your hand under your blouse and groping you, allegedly. This is a tough situation. I don't know if an impeachment's the way to go, though. It just seems like it's going to be a trauma for all of us New Yorkers.
And don't think for a second, Judy, that you can't have an impeachment, really quick impeachment. We've seen that in the House of Representatives in the second impeachment of Trump. It could go really quickly. And I am sure that there are people who are scratching their heads in both houses of the legislature of the Democratic variety.
Not to belabor this point, but it does seem when we're talking about rapidity that one of the concerns is that an investigation could drag on for a really long time. But can't you use the same, I'm not saying that you cut corners on it, but can it be a quick investigation?
Could be.
Well, I mean, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, I think, is what we have to expect in an investigation like this. Of course, it will possibly go faster if there are additional women coming forward and, as Judy said, describe and allege incidents that involve, criminal, sexual, groping, touching, grabbing, and so on.
Right.
And just to sort of state the whole complexity that Judy pointed out in terms of the challenges, if this issue is not properly addressed, imagine what kind of message that sends to women across the state and the country of their rights.
I apologize for interrupting, but when you say that to properly address it, so if the investigation comes back and shows no wrongdoing, let's say perhaps no wrongdoing by the governor, and that's what the investigation comes out, that's where this will start to reemerge, right? That he got away with something?
I mean, I suspect if there is, it would be, I assume he will be found responsible for abusing his power in relation to his employees and his staffers. So I think that's going to be very hard to walk away from that. The question
is, what happens if, let's play it forward. The Attorney General has her investigation underway, and then at the end of the investigation,
we have a minute to play it forward. But go ahead.
Cuomo is, for want of a better word, guilty. Then what happens? She can't remove him from office. So then, does it not go into an impeachment at that point?
Yes, I would think that would be the immediate response. Right.
I agree with Judy. It's going to be a mess for a long time.
Yeah.
Right. All right.
Is the impeachment process in the state legislature mirror the U.S.?
It's different. No, it's different, Ira. Without going too long, because I know Joe's got to get out of here, but in the assembly, it's very similar. But after that, in terms of the court, which would be decided, it would be the Senate plus
State Supreme Court
and other people.
I just want to end with Larry's letter regarding Joe Biden's press conference. Biden's sunglasses explain it all. He simply is following the golden rule of pilots: aviate, navigate, communicate, in that order.
Yes.
Thank you all very much. We'll be back with more after this.
And I want to thank all those people for the sippy cup stuff.
Yes.